Creating great content takes time and effort, and this podcast could not exist in the long run without great partners. This season's sponsor is Catalog. Catalog is a work hub we use every day at Modern Leaders, and I also personally recommend it to my network. It's basically your own digital headquarters, helping you and your team making high-quality decisions quickly and asynchronously, reducing the number of meetings and eliminating the chaos of modern-day work. Whether you're the COO, a product manager, or a marketing executive in a remote or hybrid team, you can find what you need, see who's working on what, and get updates on where things are at without the endless streams of emails and pings coming from everywhere. It's all in Catalog in context. Sign up now at catalogwithaq.com. That's QATALOG.com for a free 30-day trial for you and your team. Welcome to the Remote First podcast produced by Modern Leaders. Every other Tuesday, listen in to hear from large or innovative companies enabling an equitable and distributed workplace experience. Hey everyone, today I am with Lauren Charles, founder of Namal. Namal partners with leading organizations to support refugees and other underrepresented communities through skill trainings, mentorship, and remote work placement opportunities. Thank you so much for joining us, Lauren.
Hi, thanks to be here. I'm really happy to speak with you today.
It's really awesome to have you. And could you take a bit more time to explain a bit in depth to the audience how Namal serves its purpose? Like, what is it? Tell me everything.
So what we do is we support refugees to access remote work. So if I had to say one sentence, we do remote work for refugees. But there's a lot to unpack behind this. Namal was formed by my research looking at the challenges that refugees face with employment. And initially, my research focused on the Middle East. And I saw the problems that refugees were facing. And the problems weren't just lack of opportunity. The problems were the legal barriers which prevented them from working. Often, they didn't have the skills which matched the labor market. Often, they didn't have mechanisms to support their employment. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to change the narrative for employment. How can we rewrite what employment means? So this is why Namal was formed, as a way to address the challenges which refugees faced seeking employment. So we provide training in the human skills for digital employment, the human skills, soft skills, also now called power skills. And then we work with partners that do the technical skills. And then we actively try to link refugees to jobs.
That's awesome. So how does it look like, for example, like if we take like a use case of maybe a specific program that you created like recently, like how does it look like for someone, let's say, that leaves from a recent country that was in crisis coming to Europe, for example?
Right. So maybe I'll talk about the program that we're in the middle of now with MIT React and MIT Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the US. So they've got a program called React, meaning Refugee Action Hub, which sits under MIT Open Learning. And MIT do training in, the learners do a certificate in data and computer science. So Python, data analysis, and the program is fully remote. So this is, I think, one of the more innovative programs we work on because the program is all fully remote. We recruit learners from all over the world. In this current program, there are 136 learners from 22 countries. So I guess it starts with the application process. We, Namal and MIT's other partners, send the call for applications to different agencies, NGOs, contacts in the different places, and anywhere really, and applicants apply. But unfortunately, we can't take everyone, and we want to ensure that the people that we have are really the best equipped to do the jobs. So the entry criteria is quite high. They have to have good English, because that's the language which is required. And they have to have a base level of technical skills, because we aren't starting from basic digital skills. We're starting from quite an advanced level of digital skills. So they have to have a good background. So the learners which come through the program are often those who have some sort of degree before, some sort of higher education. They've certainly finished high school. Often they have a degree, and often they have some sort of work experience in their country of origin or their host country. It's a one-year program. So for the learners, they have this holistic model of education where they have the technical skills from MIT, and then they have the soft skills from us, the human skills. So we teach skills like how to manage your time. How do you navigate the remote work setting? How do you network while working remotely? How do you find a remote job? How do you manage your time? How do you set goals? How do you think critically? These are the skills that we know employers look for. And often employers say that these skills are sometimes more important than the technical skills. But we know that these are the skills that employers really, really want their employees to have. And these are particularly important when working remotely, when you don't have that face-to-face contact. So the skills are even more important for potential candidates when working in this remote work setting.
So this is kind of a learning, a training program. But those who are coming, for example, and moving countries, and they need to be able to make a living, get a job, like how can remote work support them, you know, through NAMAL to be able to continue working even though they have to leave their own country?
I think this is the beauty of remote work. Remote work travels with you. So if you think of those people who've left Ukraine who were working remotely whilst in Ukraine, and I know of a few examples, a few of the organizations that we speak to, they had Ukrainian developers who were working remotely for them. For these individuals, their work didn't stop. Okay, perhaps there was a bit of an interlude where the company recognized that they were on the move. But as soon as they were settled, which in some cases took a few weeks, maybe a month, they were able to continue with their work. So for me, this is the power, the advantage, the beauty of remote work. The work moves with you. So it doesn't matter where you are. You need your laptop and you need a good internet connectivity. So this is what we're trying to recreate. So with the learners that we have who haven't moved recently, who often have been in Lebanon or in Jordan or in Ethiopia or in Kenya for a number of years already, we want to give them the opportunity to have a job so that if they move, the job can move with them. But even if they don't move, if they stay where they are, and this is the beauty of remote work, the job comes to you. You don't have to be in a global financial capital to get these jobs. You can have the job wherever you are. If you're in Addis Ababa, if you're in Nairobi, if you're in Amman, if you're in Beirut, you can have these jobs, which previously you had to be in London or Paris or New York to do. Mm-hmm. So now the job is coming to people. People don't have to move to do these jobs.
Because it's also like, you know, for refugees, for economical reason as well, of like, you know, not being able to find work necessarily where they are, and they need to like relocate to be able to get a job. And now they don't have to.
Yes. So in a way, a lot of refugees do want to stay close to home in neighboring countries. So this changes the narrative that instead of crossing borders, going to a third country, because you have no option for work in your first host country, which is often the case, because the majority of refugees live in the developing world. The majority of refugees live in countries where even the host community struggle to find employment. The host economy can't absorb the number of people, even from the host community, that need jobs. So they live in places with often quite high unemployment rates. So this makes it difficult for refugees who live in these contexts to find work and to find dignified work and formal work as well. So now, with the new world we live in, with the expansion of the digital economy, it means that refugees and the host community, because don't forget the host community are also important, both the refugee and host community can find work which previously was not available to them.
Do you mean like, for example, the host community was not offering jobs that were maybe like more technical or more digital to refugees, and then now they have access to it?
Not quite that. So let's take Lebanon, for example. In Lebanon, refugees can only work in very few sectors. They can't work for a Lebanese tech company because those jobs are only for Lebanese nationals. Same in Jordan. But now with the digital economy, so again, this is a gray area because whilst countries legislate that refugees can't work for a Jordanian tech company or a Lebanese tech company, the rules around remote work are in the gray area. So Jordan and Lebanon, they allow digital freelancing. Well, it's not in legislation, but it's something that's accepted as that refugees can do. So whilst they can't work for a company in Jordan, they can work for a company that's not in Jordan. But remember, this is the digital economy. So both communities have access to these jobs. The refugee community and the host community have equal access to these jobs, because that's what remote work does. That's what the digital economy is. You know, that's potential. It sort of democratizes employment. It allows both communities to equally access. So instead, employers look at skills. What skills do you have? Are you the right fit for the job? As opposed to whether, you know, my host government allows me to hire this refugee who is in my host country.
Yeah, like you don't have to be in a certain kilometer area or something.
Exactly, yes. I mean, but saying that, there's still lots of challenges around the digital economy, because again, this is very new. So the countries haven't legislated for how employment should be viewed. So there's still challenges around it.
Yeah. Don't you think it will be like maybe challenging in the next couple of years, where slowly it is starting to get legislized? It becomes a bit more like organized legally. And, you know, now we see like more EOR and contractor management, and you know, for employers, is it actually okay for them to be able to hire contractors outside of the country? I mean, I love the purpose, though. Like, I really want to see more companies hiring globally for that reason as well, and including people from underrepresented communities as well. Like, I'm just wondering, I'm a bit worried of, okay, once they start, you know, wanting to do things by the book, will it actually just all collapse and then it's going to be back to zero?
Yeah, so that is something that can quite well happen. But if we look at the digital freelancing space, the gig economy, organizations like Upwork and Fiverr, people have been doing these jobs for many years, working as freelancers, as contractors. And in a way, this sort of supersedes legislation, national legislation. So when you get a job on Upwork, it's not a long-term sustainable job, but you have a project on Upwork for 1 month or 1 week or whatever it is. You're a contractor, you're not an employee. And I know the whole case with Uber, differentiating between contractors and employees. So that's a really complicated and sort of fine line to differentiate. And perhaps the case with Uber and these sort of location-dependent platforms are different. But certainly with job platforms, with sort of online work platforms, it's slightly less clear, because you don't work for the same employer. You sort of have multiple employers and not consistently.
So it works a bit better for the gig economy setup.
Yes. I mean, it does work really well for the gig economy setup, but there isn't. And this is where we need to be careful. And this is where we need to really think clearly about how it could work for other types of employment. So, for example, if a company wants to hire someone for, you know, 30 hours a week, that's not full time. Yes, it could be a part-time employee, but again, it's the gray area. So when you hire an individual in a different country, they can be hired as a contractor or as an employee. And this is where the EOR services, employee of records, for those of you in the audience that are not sure what EOR means. And this is where the employee of records sort of have two different mechanisms. The employee of records, and we work a lot with remote, they have a contractor platform and their regular EOR platform. So on the contractor platform, you can hire anyone as a contractor. And when hiring someone as a contractor, this is where this sort of employment, where it becomes vague on sort of right work employment issues. But of course, for EOR, that's where you need to have the right to work in the country, and because you're hired as an employee with the EOR service.
So if we before we get into like the very, very nitty-gritty details of this, because it is a very complex topic, and for me, I really want it to become easier, you know, for companies. But I know companies do want to get involved. So for example, like if a company said like, we do want to offer more opportunities for refugees coming from X, Y, or Z country or something, like what are the steps they can take to make that happen, maybe working with you or with your organization?
A lot depends on where the refugee lives. If the person is a Ukrainian living in Europe, that's easy. They can go through an EOR service. That's very easy. if the person is a refugee living in Jordan or in Lebanon, not so straightforward, because they don't automatically have the right to work in the country in which they exist. Same in East Asia and Malaysia. And this is where, you know, sometimes I feel that what's more important is, more, is it more important to have formal work or is it more important to have work? And this is where I would say, you want to hire someone, you can easily hire them as a contractor. You know, you set up a contractual agreement and then this person works for you for so many hours and you pay them. So I would, you know, I would say, you know, if the legal parameters are less clear, and I'm definitely not a lawyer, you know, easy to start with a contractor. And in a way, this is a way to make sure that people have opportunities. And it's not a way to skirt along the law, because often the law doesn't work for refugees. 70% of refugees live in countries which restrict, which have restrictions around their right to work. That's the majority.
It's insane.
It's insane.
It's like, how are they able to like make a living? How are they able to like, you know,
yes,
be able to live in this new country if they are unable to work or do anything?
Exactly.
How are they surviving?
Exactly. And this is where sometimes it just doesn't make sense. And host countries benefit when refugees are employed. In places like Uganda, refugees automatically have the right to work, equal employment opportunities as Ugandans. And, you know, and refugees, you know, can be successful, but they have to, there has to be an infrastructure, the legislation that supports them to be successful. Otherwise, they will work, you know, they will work. Refugees do work. They just work in informal, precarious conditions. And, you know, often earning below the minimum wage. But the digital economy is a way for those with the skills, and not everyone, you know, the reality is not everyone has the skills to navigate this space, but those with the skills can get better paid, dignified jobs. And this benefits the host community. The governments have money coming into the country which doesn't originate from the country. So if a refugee in Jordan works for a US company, this refugee is getting dollars from their company, which they will spend in Jordan. They won't be spending the money in Syria because they don't live there, or in the US. They're spending the money in Jordan. So this is a win-win for governments to actually allow refugees the right to remote work. And this is something that I've been trying to advocate for. Even if countries don't allow refugees to work in the host community, yes, it's political. They want to protect the host population. But surely the right to remote work would benefit everyone. There's money coming into the country from their foreign employer. And of course, the host community is equally able to access employment in the digital economy. So for me, this seems to be a win-win.
Hey everyone, I'm your host, Daphne Laforêt, founder of Modern Leaders, a consulting collective enabling you to walk the talk and scale your company for the remote-first future. Our team comes from over a decade of distributed team leadership experience, where we work with organizations from 25 to 5,000 employees. And I am so excited to have put together this podcast to share with you everything that we've been learning over the years. This is the Remote First Podcast.
There are so much opportunities that are just kind of lying there, waiting to be picked up by new companies to be like, hey, we're going to start a program in our company and we're going to start, you know, hiring more in these specific regions. And I'd love to see more programs like that. Do you also help companies to create these programs to hire in countries?
Yes. I mean, certainly this is really where we're headed next. And, you know, you sort of asked us the direction in which we're headed. We know a lot of companies want to employ refugees. We know they do, but often they just don't know where to start. They don't know how to navigate the complications around, you know, around how to hire refugees, how to even find refugees, how to ensure that they have the right skills, how to ensure that, you know, that they have what's required, and, you know, and even how to navigate the interview process. How do I navigate the onboarding? These things are, you know, these things might be different from hiring someone within the country in which you operate. So yes, we do, you know, we are working toward providing much more support for companies, because we realize that without companies, what we're doing is pointless. Companies are the ones that we're working for in a way, because we're training the talent for companies to address the talent gaps, which we know they have. So yes, we need more companies to come up, you know, to come to us and say, yes, we want to work with you. We want to hire the talent, because we have talent who are highly skilled, highly qualified, and a lot of them are already working for European companies and already working remotely. We just need a lot more companies to step up, because we know companies need talent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, talent war, isn't it? Well, that's awesome. Is there anything else you want to share about, you know, a project that Namal is working on, or something that, you know, you saw a very good thing unfold from it that was a success story?
Yes. One of the really, I think, the part that I like the most is our mentorship program. And this is where companies can, you know, can support the refugee talent by being mentors. And in a way, this is a non-committal way for companies to really, as an organization, learn about the skills that the refugee talent has. So we sort of have two ways that we run this project. We sort of open it up to anyone. So anyone that wants to be a mentor can sign up and be a mentor. We really like companies to sponsor the mentorship program. This is a way that companies can sort of express their commitment to the work that we do. They sponsor the mentorship program. So they have some of their employees become mentors. We provide training for all the mentors and support. There's a mentorship guide so that the mentorship relationship is scaffolded. So in case the pair needs support about how to, you know, how to navigate, we have the guide, which sort of goes through the topics that need to be covered and some ideas of questions and activities and extra resources. And for companies, when they actually work with a refugee talent like this, it really gives the companies an opportunity to see the talent we're training. But also, I feel about the mentorship program, it's a way of humanizing the refugee context. So many times refugees are dehumanized in the press. And the reality is that most people have never met a refugee. So for me, when people mentor a refugee, when they see the refugee crisis on TV or read it in the news, they can humanize what they see. They can see the people being portrayed in the media as people because they have mentored a refugee. So they understand that the refugees that they see have skills, are often highly skilled, have qualifications.
I think that people think that they just are like not smart people coming from, you know, this is the kind of like...
This is the stereotype.
The stereotype, yeah. They're kind of, you know, putting them unskilled, in a classification.
Yeah. Unskilled, uneducated, can't contribute to society and economies in which they're coming. And I think by this mentoring process, we want individuals who would never have the opportunity to work with refugees, because of course not everyone can be lucky, you know, to do the work that we do, but this means that it gives people, regular people, the opportunity to mentor, to not only to pass on their talent, but also to learn from the refugees. And when we do the training for the mentors, we say to them, you know, yes, you're in an amazing position having to pass on your expertise and experience to junior talent, but also you have the opportunity to learn so much from this person, you know, who you would never meet on a day-to-day basis. You will learn as much from them as they learn from you. So for me, this mentoring program is, I think, one of the highlights of the way that we operate as an organization.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Lauren, for joining the podcast. It's our short discussion, but I think that it would be really nice for people to reach out to you if they also want to hire refugees, they want to mentor and be part of what you're working on. What can they do to reach out to you?
So on our website, we have a contact form. You can fill out the contact form. You can find me on LinkedIn, Lorraine Charles. Yeah, just reach out to us and we'll see how we can help you. We're always looking for mentors. We're always looking for companies to hire talent. We're looking for companies who want to have interns. So even if your company only wants to be a company that does interns, 2 interns every year, that's great. We really want companies to be more engaged, because this is why we do the work that we do, for companies to address the talent needs of companies and also to, you know, to provide you talent, diverse talent, which we know you need, which we know improves profitability of companies. So in a way, it's a win-win for everyone. You get great talent, diverse talent, people which will positively contribute to your organization, but also you support in communities which face conflict, which are fragile. So it's a win-win for everyone.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing what you're working on. And thank you for doing that as well. Thank you for creating NEMA.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Remote First. You can find all links and show notes in the episode description. And if you found value in this show, we'd love your rating on your listening app of choice. Thank you for being here. See you next time.